Today's episode of the Gestalt Education Show is brought to you by three of our favorite sponsors, Human Locomotion, Core 360 Bell, and Dynamic Disc Designs. All the information can be found below. By now, you have definitely heard us talk about them, so check out the show notes, click the links, use the codes, and make sure you support our favorite people. As always, we got a great episode lined up for you today, and thanks for tuning in. All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of the Gestalt Education Show. Today we are in Viva Las Vegas. So one of our favorite weekends of the year, Brett, Parker Las Vegas. We're here at the brand new Caesars Forum. They actually outgrew the Paris and had to move to this to the new Caesars Forum, and it was awesome. You actually just got off stage, Brett, so you talked a little bit about the it factor, the other things outside of just the things we do manually that actually help people get better or get good results. And so I thought you did a great job. Congratulations. But today we are we're sitting down with a speaker that's going to be featured tomorrow, and I first heard Mike Boyle actually speak at a Perform Better in Orlando, Florida. Man, that must have been 7 or 8 years ago. But Mike, you are the owner of Mike Boyle Strength Conditioning. You're basically worldwide as the foremost expert in this field of strength conditioning. And the thing that Brett and I love about you most probably is that you're not afraid to wrinkle feathers. And you're not afraid to kind of go against the grain a little bit and get play in the mud a little bit when it comes to people on social media and other things like that. And so today we're going to break down a lot of things. You've worked with professional athletes, high school athletes, every form of athlete, but something that we were talking about off camera is that your new kind of obsession, or not obsession, or new thing is just everyday people, and your athletes that are just normal everyday people in your gym. And so we're going to kind of talk about what we can do to prevent injuries with them, and how we can train them properly. So thanks for sitting down with me. Can you just give us a little background? You're kind of known for training in the unilateral movement versus bilateral movements, or bilateral support. So can you kind of talk about when you first started thinking about that idea and kind of what the concept was behind that?
So I've told this story a bunch of times, but I started with an injured hockey player, with this guy, Cam Neely, who's now the president of the Boston Bruins. Yep. So there's the hockey fans in the world will recognize that name, but I would say when I started at that point, I was probably your conventional meathead strength coach, bilateral, simplistic, and I had this guy who had a really bad patellofemoral problem and was unable to play, and I realized, okay, I need to really dive into knee rehab. And kind of the thing that I had always done was, okay, who's the best person? And a friend of mine led me actually to Gary Gray at that time and said, Gary Gray is the guy you need to talk to. So I started communicating with Gary Gray, which probably at that time, we're talking early 90s, 92, 93, something like that. I imagine I called him on the telephone, believe it or not. And he blew my mind. He was going on and on and on about kind of function and patellofemoral joint and I was kind of nodding my head thinking, this guy's really smart. I have no idea what he's talking about. I'm so lost right now that it's not even funny. And so I signed up for his course, which was called When the Foot Hits the Ground. It was actually in Phoenix. And so in probably, like I said, I 91 or two, I went to Phoenix. I went to When the Foot Hits the Ground, and Gary literally changed the way I thought about everything, because he started talking about the science of functional anatomy. And I don't know if I'd ever heard anybody use the term functional anatomy at that point. And he started to talk about what the muscles actually did. And I just remember sitting there, and it was really funny, because you're in a group of, there's probably guys like me, strength coaches, physical therapists, probably chiropractors. And you could see some people sitting there like this, and they're just, no, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. And there's other people like me that are kind of looking like, whoa, like this is literally like when you see like the thing over the guy's head, you know, mind blown. It's like, okay, my mind is being blown right now, because he started talking about the idea. He started out talking about lower body function. He said, lower body function is so simple. He was like, all the muscles do the same thing. And I remember sitting there thinking, all the muscles do the same thing. Where's he going with this? And then he started explaining that when you put your foot on the ground, every muscle resists flexion. He said, so if you think about function, you know, the eccentric function is the resistance of flexion. So if we look at your glutes, what are your glutes doing? And he said, your glutes are preventing flexion of your ankle, knee, and hip. What are your hamstrings doing? They're preventing flexion of your ankle, knee, and hip. What's your quad doing? It's preventing flexion of your ankle, knee, and hip. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh man, he's right. And then he said, when you push off the ground, it's like they all do the same thing again. They all act together as a system, as a unit, to extend all of those joints. And then he started going on and saying, so there are no knee extensors. There's no knee flexors. And I don't know if he used the term dead person anatomy at that time or not, but he said, it doesn't really, you know, what we were taught in school isn't really how these muscles work. So I came back after that week and suddenly I'm inadvertently a functional training guy, because I started thinking that functional training, and when I wrote functional training for sports, I had to write a definition. And I said, it's the application of functional anatomy to training. So what we're trying to do is look at functional anatomy, say, what does that muscle actually do? And then how can I, whatever, facilitate that muscle? How can I get that muscle to do the right thing at the right time? So I went back and I gave away my leg extension. I gave away my leg curl. I gave away my leg press. I went to our phys ed people and I was like, do you guys want a leg extension, leg curl, and leg press? And they were like, oh, absolutely. We'll take another one. And I was like, great. You know, can you get somebody to get it out of here tomorrow? And they came in and they took it. So I haven't had those machines since the 90s. Now the weirder part is that in knee rehab, leg extensions are making this huge comeback in the lab.
Because the eccentric load,
Well, oh no, you know why? Because people got to sell machines. That's why.
Well, there's that.
That's it. That was why I was before. That was why, because Gary was really funny. When I asked Gary, like, how did you end up like this? He said, I didn't have the money to buy a Cybex in the 80s like everybody else. So I had to figure out another way to do it. And everybody else had the sunk cost. At that time, $25,000 for a Cybex was a lot of money. You know, and you got data and printouts, all the shit that people love. Oh, look at, you know, you can see, you know, torques, and I can tell you ratios and all bullshit that makes absolutely no difference in my mind at all. But that was kind of where we were at. How's that? I'm going to give you really long answers to really short. Well,
that was perfect. We went up to his home turf. We did two podcasts with him. He actually had a huge influence on me too. And to that point, I remember the first course I took with him. He asked somebody, he's like, what does tibialis posterior do? And they're like, oh, it's a plantar flexor inverted of the ankle. And he's like, no, it controls eversion and it controls dorsiflexion. So then he'd talk for another 5 minutes. He'd go back and they could never get the concept. So they kept just saying, it's a plantar flexor. He's like, no, it controls dorsiflexion eversion. And I think, like, he's on the Mount Rushmore of function, in my opinion. I feel like no one knows him anymore.
Right, no, because unfortunately, he went off the deep end a little bit because he's a very religious guy, and he started to weave the religion into the training part, and I think that put a lot of people off. And it started to get I once said to him, you can't combine physical and metaphysical. They got too weird. They started making up their own words, econcentric. You know, and you started saying, okay,
Paul Truncula.
Yeah, you know, you're too far out here now, and you need to shift. He never wanted to shift back to the center. He kind of wanted to be where he was, and I think maybe thought leaders are like that.
Well,
I don't believe?
I mean, one of Gary's main tenets is the way to turn on muscles is to take joints to end range and three planes of motion. Gary's kind of notorious for doing all kinds of stuff with the knee that some other people wouldn't do.
No, like, and I actually wrote long letters to him. I wrote articles about it because I wrote an article one time called Preventative or Provocative. And I said, the idea was you could get to a point where something that you were hoping was going to be preventative is now provocative. So if I start saying, I deliberately want you to go into valgus, I may be causing the problem that I was seeking to solve. So we started looking at the idea, like, to me, triplanar function, like unilateral training, and this is why I started to kind of have my own version of what I had learned from Gary, but anytime I stand on one foot, I'm doing a triplanar exercise because I'm stabilizing in two planes while I move in one. And so I said to me, I don't need, like, I would look at, and I, I actually analyzed one of Gary's early videos, had his lunge matrix on it. And one of the things that I said to people was, if you watch the lunge matrix, he has two people doing it, and they do two completely different lunge matrices. One guy is a very hip dominant guy. One guy is a very knee dominant guy. And I was kind of like, you can't say that's the same thing. Like, you can't look at that and think one guy's kind of reaching for his feet and the other guy's kind of squatting to get the dumbbell down to his feet. And my feeling was, we need to be a bit more particular. And I felt like the stuff that Gary was liking, you know, like you said, end range, triplanar, would get dangerous if you really tried to do it with healthy athletes. You'd get to a point where you'd think, okay, I can't do that. I need to be able to look. I need to look at some exercises. Right, exactly. Under load. That's what I mean. Like, when you start thinking about, can I load this in the way that I would need to load it from a progressive resistance standpoint to get the result that I want, I don't think you'd be doing it safely then. So I guess that was where I kind of had my that was my break with Gary. Suddenly, even though he changed my world completely, I got to a point where I said, I'm willing to go this far. And that was just even the unilateral part, because no one at that time, I mean, unilateral training wasn't being done. And suddenly we started to look at it and say, no, wait a second, but now we want to look at this unilateral training idea and really start to explore it, I guess, start to look at it and think, okay, where can we go? What can we do? My talk tomorrow, orthopedic costs. What can we do safely? What can we do that's going to get somebody better and not get somebody hurt?
Yeah, because, I mean, you have, you know, the old school thought is, you know, we have to watch that we don't load, you know, joints or the connect chain of the body too much. And then the latest research is showing, like, on overall mortality and morbidity that, you know, if people work out, you will add years to their life. So I think it's to reconcile those two thoughts is difficult.
Yeah, it is. Like, where's the ground lie in there? What's too much load? And,
right.
And that's, I guess, the question would be another good question for you.
And is, I think you have to look at it and say, where am I and what am I doing? Because one of the things that, so guys like me, basically we're looking to rehab professionals to learn. But rehab professionals do rehab, generally speaking. They're not training athletes. So I had to look at this and think, how can I make what is conceptually a good idea in my mind into something that is actually sort of trainable, scalable, and I can safe, because again, my third slide is, you know, Hippocratic Oath, right? First, do no harm.
Right.
So I think we have to look at that part and say, how do I make this work in a way that's going to be both safe and effective?
Right. Well, I mean, your reputation is to be a simpleton. Not that you don't understand complexity, but that in a world where people are making things difficult, you believe in breaking it down and making it simple. So can you explain, like, what put you on that path of those thoughts? Because strength conditioning can be so complex if you...
Well, I think part of it is, I have a million slides about, you know, Einstein, you know, if you can't explain it simply, you don't really understand it. So I think a lot of people hide behind the fact that I'll use a whole bunch of big words and I'll try to make this seem really complicated and I'll make everybody think that I'm really smart. But I look at it and think, people might think I'm smart because I can explain things in a simple way. And that's how I would prefer to be known, rather than someone come and say, oh, I went and saw Mike speak and he used a whole bunch of big words and I had no idea what he was talking about. Most people will come and think, wow, I understood some concepts that I didn't understand previously because I made them simple. So I want to be able to present kind of simple analogies, simple visuals where people can look and think, oh, I get it. Versus, as you said, the people who are deliberately making it complex because they want somebody to think they're smarter. I don't really care if anyone thinks I'm smart.
So what was your epiphany moment in that patellofemoral case? It was that, what was the...
Well, one, the epiphany moment was, does it hurt? And again, I always say I wrote an article, but I wrote it. One of my favorite article that I ever wrote is called Does It Hurt? And I've always said in a rehabilitative setting, if you have an athlete and you want them to get better, you can't be doing things that hurt. And I still read stuff where people say, oh, if it's 2 out of 10, it's fine. I'm like, no, it's not. I want 0 out of 10. If I say, if we're going to do an exercise, so this guy, Neely, I just started looking at it and he would say, yeah, you know, I do the leg extension machine like they tell me to do. And the next day my knee's really sore and I've got fluid. So I thought, okay, the leg extension machine obviously irritates your patellofemoral joint. I don't think I knew enough then to maybe understand why, but I started with the things that Gary had told me, started trying to construct exercises that would not make him do that. And we started playing around with vertical tibia, and it's really interesting. I listened to a podcast with Jill Cook maybe 2 years ago, and she was saying exactly what we were doing in the 90s is what they do with their patellofemoral pain people, that their number one rule with patellofemoral pain is, does it hurt? Find exercises that don't hurt. Find a way. That's why even now we've gone back to isometrics. I would have told you 5 years ago, if you said we were going to be doing wall sits, I would have been like, yeah, right. We're going to be doing fucking wall sits. Like, not a chance.
Right.
We do wall sits now. We do wall sits. We do single leg wall sits. Because if you can get somebody to fatigue their quadricep mechanism in a way that produces zero pain, okay, if that's the exercise that works, then that's where we're going with. And then we might move to split squat ISO, and then we might move to a vertical tibia split squat ISO, and then a vertical tibia split squat. But we're going to keep playing in that, I want this to not hurt. I'm not going to irritate that joint at all, zero. And I think that applies to low backs. I think it applies to knees. I think it applies to rotator cuffs. If you're asking somebody to work through pain, the only time it, from a research standpoint, and again, I can go back and forth. I always use research to support things that I wanted to support, and then I completely deny it when I don't agree with them. But with actual tendon pain, you can have somebody get tendon pain. But anybody who's getting, I always say to people when they come to me and they say, okay, I'm doing this, and I always think, where are they going to point? If they point to the wrong places, then I know we're doing it wrong. If someone said, I'm doing it and it hurts right here, I'm like, okay, hurts right on your patella tendon, that's probably going to be okay. We're probably going to be all right like that. It hurts like here, I'm like, not good. That exercise isn't right. And maybe it's just the loading parameter isn't right. Maybe the contraction type isn't right. But whatever it is, it's not right. And we've like talked about being a simpleton. I've gotten all kinds of people back from all kinds of problems at really, really high levels with using nothing more than, does that hurt? And if they say, I always thought, because the article says, does it hurt is a yes, no question. So if I ask you, Brett, does that exercise hurt? If you say, well, I'm like, yes. If you say, well, after I warm up, it's pretty good. I'm like, that's yes. A little, yes. The only thing I want is an absolute no. Doesn't hurt at all. Then we can work from there. And I always think you take simple exercise technique and add progressive resistance, you're off to the races.
Are you a firm believer in that, like, fundamental movements are fundamental movements, and like, you don't do things individually for their, that it would be sports specific, or are you somewhere in between?
We don't do anything that would be sports specific. I always think sports specific is practice. So if you want to do sports specific stuff, go practice. But I do think we'll sort of walk the line sometimes, particularly in rotational exercise, where you might look at stuff and see, there's something imitative there. When you start looking at, I'm a big FMS guy. I've always been, again, I've been probably as heavily influenced by Gray as I was. It's really Gary Gray and Greg Cook.
Yeah.
Shades of Grays. But but when I look, I remember Gray wrote an article late 1998 maybe on, I think he called it functional movement for the torso or something like that, where he started talking about training diagonal patterns. And it was another one of those where you went, yep, we should do that. Because at that time we were so purely sagittal. And suddenly he started talking about this idea of chopping and lifting patterns. So those are areas where I think we do maybe dabble in the imitative, not necessarily sport specific. You'll never see anybody kind of fake swinging a golf club kind of thing, or with a, you know, with a bat attachment attached to the stack. But you may see people doing some rotational torso exercise that looks like some kind of striking skill. So I guess I'm on the fence.
But a hockey player and a baseball player training wouldn't look all that different in your gym?
You would honestly, and I say this, if you came to our gym, you would see the best athletes in the world, and particularly our females. If I said, okay, tell me what that girl does, you would probably be wrong at least 50% of the time. Because you might look and think, oh, definitely basketball player, and I'd be like, nope, defenseman. And you might look at somebody else and say, that girl's a hockey player. I'd be like, nope, lacrosse. You would never be able to look at the training program. Our training programs, honestly, baseball is a little bit different because I do think you have to be whatever, shoulder friendly, shoulder respective with baseball players in a way that you're probably not with a lot of other people. But I look at it now and think I probably did a bad job with my quarterbacks back in the day when we did football. Like I would look at my quarterbacks and think I would be training them much more like baseball players than I would be football players at this stage. So they would have been the one group that would have had their own program, really their own program. That because you think about football, get one guy who's a thrower and everybody else is a whatever, a smasher into everybody else guy. You know, they have some variation, but one guy, his job is to throw. So it's literally like you have a team that has one pitcher. But so I think, you know, you can, generally speaking, though, if you looked at ours, 80-20, 90-10, you'd come in and think, wow, everybody's following the same template in terms of everybody's doing plyos, everybody's throwing medicine balls, everybody's doing some sort of explosive power exercise, everybody's doing pushing, pulling, knee dominant, hip dominant. It wouldn't look very much different at all.
What does load management look like then in those different athletes and in your gym? So we kind of talked about loads consequences at the beginning of the podcast, but then like, what's your philosophy on managing that load through the off season and in the season? You know, how do you kind of manage all that with the different athletes?
It's interesting. We're super low volume anyway, just by nature. Again, when you think about your influences, I was really heavily influenced by the hit guys early on, the old Nautilus one set, the failure guys. Because there was some free weight guys, Ken Leisner, which most people would not recognize that name, but Stuart McRobert, guys who talked about this idea of you could do really well kind of with one set to failure. That's probably closer to where we are from a load management standpoint. So we have, as for instance, we train the best, two of the best women's lacrosse attackers in the United States, probably in the world, because we're the best country in the world at women's lacrosse. And they train pretty much year round because they have like a pro league in the summer. But this girl just went and scored 6 goals this weekend in an exhibition game. And she was lifting on Thursday. And she went down there on Saturday and had 6 goals and was like, I felt great. Yeah. But our volume is never excessive. Our volume of jumps is very low. We tend to be 25 or so foot contacts a day. You'll never see, I'm not an extensive, I don't like the extensive plyo idea. We won't do a lot of, I think sometimes we're calling warm-up exercises extensive plyos, like we've renamed warm-ups and said, oh, those are extensive plyos. I'm like, no, they're not. They're just warm-ups. Mm-hmm. They're not extensive plyos. You know, you can't be saying, you know, if somebody's skipping or, you know, bouncing through the ladder or whatever, that's a plyo. But now you get into even people, how do you define, like I would say, we probably do plyos 25% of the time, and 75% of the time we jump or hop. Mm-hmm. Because it's not really, if you jump and stick or hop and stick, it's really not plyometric. It's just jump training. So I think there's a lot of nuance, but the nuance is simple. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Am I making sense? Sometimes I wonder am I the only one?
What does the assessment look like? So obviously it sounds like you are using SFMA or FMS. What are the other things that you do day one when you're assessing your athletes?
We don't do anything. Again, you said I'm a simpleton. We do nothing. Not a thing. We don't do any testing. We just show up and start training.
Start training, yeah.
Even FMS, I don't FMS people anymore. We FMS our personal training clients, our one-to-one clients, because I think FMS is a great sales tool. It's really good if you want someone. So if I get someone who's hurt, if you came to me and said I'm injured, I would FMS you.
Right.
If I was going to train you, I would FMS you to see, does something smack me in the face that is so, or should have been so obvious. I'll give you a perfect example. This guy, Gilbert Arenas, who was a real good NBA player, came to us and he had had an abdominal problem. So he had missed a bunch of the season was a real good player, was an all-star at that time. And I'm kind of looking at him and thinking, I have no idea what's wrong with this guy. And then I thought, screw it. So we'll just run him through the FMS just for the hell of it. And I observed him walk in. He walked in. He was super duck-footed, but I thought, whatever, he's super duck-footed. I didn't really ask him, were you always that way? I didn't think about that at the time. But we start FMSing him, and we're doing inline lunge, and he can't inline lunge with one foot in the back. Like, he's kind of like trying to get in position. I'm like, what's the matter? He goes, oh, I had turf toe last year. I said, you had turf toe? I said, and I said, did you always walk the way you walk? And he said, no. He said, I started walking that way because of my turf toe. Really hurt.
Couldn't toe.
So, but what you realize, and he literally described, this is how I got hurt. I backed into somebody. I did a spin move, and I just felt something go in my stomach. And I thought, here's a guy who took away all his rotation by moving his feet out. But he was literally, my point is, he was compensating for a turf toe and ended up with an abdominal strain. So there are sometimes where you get where something hops off at you. But if I have healthy people who come, I'll generally just go. So it's a little bit variable.
And then if you had only one exercise for the rest of your career and only one, what would it be?
Do you have an award for the lamest question of the podcast?
Right, the one
exercise question.
You got one.
I probably would have to go trap bar deadlift at this point. I would probably I probably would go with a simple bilateral strength exercise, which is totally off the Mike Boyle
board.
You would be like, if we let everybody here guess,
scandalous.
No one. But if you really started thinking, okay, I can only do one thing. And I only say that because I remember reading. So the guy who got me thinking about deadlifts was Allison Felix's coach. I can't think of the name, but the book was called Bear Powered, and he had been Alice Felix's strength coach, and as I'm talking, his name will jump back into my head, and I'll spit it out for you, but one of the things that he said is that deadlifts are better than squats because they work more muscle mass. He said you don't get the upper back and grip strength from squats that you do from deadlifts, and I remember sitting there thinking, you know, he's right. And that was when we went back to deadlifts. Barry Ross. See, I knew if I just sat here long enough and didn't think about it, it would come to me. But Barry Ross. So when I start looking and thinking, if I really want maximum bang for my buck, I get something, particularly with trap bar, I get this like hybrid kind of exercise. I called it a squed lift in an article because it's sort of in between a squat and a deadlift because you can do a very squatty deadlift with your trap bar, but now you're getting your forearms, you're getting your upper back, like you're really, from a strength perspective, probably maximizing the potential bang for the buck.
Love it. What about like periodization for your athletes and like, are you educating them? I know I'm asking you other things like that. But, like,
I love, no, this is perfect. It's like you must have read my mind.
Like periodization, like this is such a big topic now.
Periodization, I wrote another article. I have the same response. I wrote an article. I wrote, is periodization strength and conditioning's biggest waste of time? People love to geek out about Russian cycles and this. We're like, don't do the same thing for more than 3 weeks. That's periodization. Our athletes now are so smart that I'll look at them and they'll be like, what do I do next week? And they're like, I know, 5 pounds more than last week, right? And I'm like, exactly, 5 pounds more than last week. And that's our periodization. And then after 3 weeks, we switch the reps. But our periodization, if you'd look at it and think, my God, Stone Age. We're still working off. Our periodization format comes out of a Charles Poliquin article from 1988 called Variety in Strength Training. I send it to people all. Whenever they ask me about periodization, I send them that article. I'm like, read this article. And he just talked about alternating periods of accumulation with periods of intensification. So accumulate a little bit more volume, accumulate a little bit, you know, or develop a little more intensity. Accumulate a little bit more volume, develop a little bit more intensity. And then you just have to figure out, how am I going to accumulate my volume? Maybe I can accumulate my volume through eccentric work. Maybe I can accumulate my volume through isometric time under tension. Or maybe I'll just accumulate my volume the old-fashioned way with number of reps. And then 3 weeks later, we'll intensify. We'll lower the reps and increase the weight, so that there's a little wavy kind of pattern. That's it.
Perfect. Well, the next thing I really wanted to talk to you about is you've created a culture not only at your training facility, but also through your group training programs and your education format too, with the
CFSC.
Sorry. So. Okay. Like, talk to us about culture. Like, how do you get this all your people on board with your philosophy and kind of how you've built this giant thing that you now have?
Have you read Legacy? Oh, you guys, I'm looking at these guys. If they haven't read it, you got to read Legacy. Yeah. Legacy is a rugby book, actually, but it's probably the best sports culture book ever written. And one of the chapters of Legacy is No Dickheads. So that is how we have developed what we have developed. A strict no dickhead philosophy. Because if you think, and I don't know about chiropractic per se, but fitness is filled with dicks. Narcissistic dicks.
Yeah.
Seriously. I mean, people that are so, you know, it's kind of the standard quote, you know, when the person is wrapped up in themselves, the package is generally small. And it's like, you end up in a situation where, in fitness, you have to weed. So now I look at people and think, if someone says my hobbies are bodybuilding or powerlifting or Olympic lifting or fitness competitions, I'm like, cross them off the list. Dicks, yeah. More than likely. I would say if somebody shows up with their own food in Tupperware, I'm always like, Mr. Tupperware, dick.
Like, a gallon jug of water.
Gallon jug of water. The bigger around,
the water,
dick.
The bigger the dick.
Yeah, exactly. So, but because of that,
wears tights to a job interview.
Yes, we pick out the best people, and I always say I want people that want to help other people, not people that want to help themselves. Like if I have to look at you and think you're going to tell me like his watch is going to go off and he's going to be like, oh, time to eat again. I got to have 25 grams of protein right now, or the fucking world's going to end. Dude, I'm like. Dick, like not our guy.
I know sleep's important, but people are annoying about sleep too.
Oh,
like,
yeah, all that.
I gotta go to sleep at 5:30 p.m.
I've got
to
get 8 hours.
I got a meal prep. I'm like, go to brunch, go drinking on Sunday. Like, don't meal prep. Live your life. Have some fun.
Sorry to interrupt this episode, guys. Hope you're enjoying it. Real quick, we have an amazing, amazing opportunity. The DNS World Congress is coming to Chesterfield, Missouri this June 14th through the 16th, 2024. If you guys attended our NDS or our Neurodynamics Congress, you know that this is something that's very close to Brett and I's heart, something that we are going to keep doing and keep doing and keep doing. So this year's Congress is all about DNS, dynamic neuromuscular stabilization. This is literally like looking into the ocean, as Brett says. This is the lens that we look through each and every one of our patients with. And this is going to be an amazing opportunity because Pavel is back in town. So the originator, the creator of DNS, Pavel Kolash, is coming to the States for the first time in 5 or 6 years. I don't even know how long it's been. He's bringing along with him Elena Kobosova, which is literally the backbone of DNS. She's one of the most underrated neurologists in the world. So we're super excited to hear from her. Marcella Safarova, if you haven't heard her speak, she is literally the queen of pediatrics and musculoskeletal health. We also are going to have almost every single UNS instructor at the Congress who's going to be speaking. It's going to include demos, lectures, hands-on. We're going to have, as always, a get-together afterwards with your chance to talk to these guys face-to-face and have a couple drinks with them. This is going to be a great, great opportunity. There's also, it's a great price too, especially for students. It's only $4.99. So be sure to use the code DNSstudent to get your discount on that. For more information or if you have questions, go to gestaltedu.com/DNS-Congress. Thanks for tuning in, guys. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
So we have, our people.
Cheers to that.
This is our people here.
No, that's this, our
yeah, exactly. This is why we're here during this podcast. Right. So here we go. But so we do a really good job picking people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then once you do that, everything else is easy. Because if you get people who are nice, reasonably intelligent, want to get better, you're in a good spot.
Yeah.
How long does it take you to know like a coach in your gym is going to work or not?
The good thing is almost everyone has come out of the internship program. Mm-hmm. They are either in the internship program or in a couple of cases, Brendan, who's here today, Brendan was a friend of one of the other interns who just kept coming and hanging around. My partner thought he was a spy. He was always like, what's that kid doing? Why is he always here? But he just wanted to be around. He liked the environment. And after a while, we thought, well, hire Brendan. Brendan really wants to be here, and he's a good guy. Mm-hmm. So he's one of the few that wasn't really an intern first, but most everybody went through the internship process. But also, I made some bad calls early on. Luckily for me now, when you get, I'm at year 42, you can kind of wash away some of the early ones that you thought you could help or save or whatever, and didn't work.
Can you talk us through the internship program? Like what the expectations are, what their responsibilities are, and things like that? Because we have an internship program at our office too, and it's something that's, I mean, we've worked really hard on, and it's been so selfishly, I want to learn from you too.
Well, the biggest thing with our internship is it is immersive. So they do the workout every day throughout the entire summer. And we have the same thing. We have we have the first intern meeting, particularly in the summer when we have our biggest group. We have 20 some odd interns. And I always say, this is the most negative that I will ever be. There's going to be a lot of don'ts. Don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. But we want to lay it out for them very clearly what the expectations are. And one of the expectations, I always said, if you want me to not like you, then arm farm on Friday is a good way to piss me off. If I come in and all of a sudden you're in there doing guns, or if I see you ever with your shirt off, or we talk about
tripod in the gym.
We talk about clothing all the time. I literally say, okay, if you're going to be here, you should have clothes that fit. So we literally tell you what your shirt size is. So I'm like, oh, I need a medium. No, you're a large. put a freaking large on, okay? Like, no one cares what your arms look like. No one cares. Again, I don't want people. Anyway, I was saying, any adult that talks about how much they can lift, dick, right?
Yeah,
when someone starts telling you, like I was saying, no conversation should ever revolve around an adult's bench press.
Right.
It's just not what should happen. And so we have that meeting where we're very kind of firm and open and explain. I would say your shorts should cover your ass. Your clothes should look like they belong to you. All these simple things that we want in the beginning. And then we tell them, you're doing our workouts. I don't care what you like. I don't care what you do. We have made a couple of exceptions. If we did have some, we had a couple of people that were in fact competitive power lifters and said, okay, can I come in on Friday and back squat or something? And, I actually have a meet and I'm trying to do this. Okay, maybe we'll make an exception for that kind of stuff. But in general, they have to, if you're physically able, you do everything. I mean, you run time sprints, you do plyos, you do jumps, you do all the agility drills. You have to be able, if you don't move well, you will learn to move well. We won't let you run groups until you do. So, and until you're an effective demonstrator, you don't get to run a group. You won't be in charge. And it's very immersive, and then you kind of earn your ability to coach. Kids that show they can coach fairly quickly, we'll start letting them coach. Kids that can't, we'll do just a lot of observation. So they end up, unfortunately, they probably do too much setup, breakdown, putting stuff away, that kind of stuff. We have mandatory education. The one thing that we do with everybody, we have a mandatory staff meeting every week for our entire staff, which I think is the best thing that we do. Because we sit down every week, generally speaking, and talk about the things that we aren't doing well.
Yeah.
Or the things that we think we can do better. And so all of that goes into the process of getting these. So they're there for 10 weeks. And week one, day one is learn the program, do the program. But way more emphasis on learning it than doing it.
Yeah.
And we talk a lot about sort of the soft skill part, about learning names, about how to communicate with not only with kids, with adults, with each other. We talk about hygiene, honestly, which is, I always say, that's a terrible thing you have to talk about. We always say to people, we're going to talk to you about your breath. We're going to talk to you about your body odor. These are all things that we've had trouble with in our internship, where someone would be like, oh my God, this guy, I can't. We had one guy who was, he was eating a ton of garlic because garlic is supposed to be good for you. And he stunk. I mean, we had to bring him in the office and be like,
intervention.
You have got to brush your teeth 3 times a day and you got to lay off the garlic because people can't work with you. People are literally backing away from you because of the odor that you're giving off. So when you say all encompassing, it is literally all encompassing.
Yeah.
How to act, how to dress. We go through, because this is the best intern story ever. We go through how to break down a box. And you would say, why would you go through how to break down a box? Because not once, but twice we have gone out, we get a big delivery, and then an intern will walk in and say, the dumpster's full, what do we do now? And I would go out and look, and the dumpster would be full of what?
Full boxes, yeah.
Whole boxes. And the dumpster could have been 6 inches on the bottom if they had just had the common sense to realize, I need to break these boxes down and flatten them out. Instead, they threw them all. And I'm in the dumpster, and they're looking at me thinking, he's in the dumpster breaking boxes down. And I'm like, yes, I am in the dumpster breaking boxes down, thinking about how stupid you are the whole time, that you didn't think about that as the dumpster filled with air, effectively. And we were going to pay for an air dump.
Brett's got a great story. One of his interns throwing needles, like acupuncture needles, in the trash. So the story goes, you made him go out there and basically
Yeah, he had to go through. He had to literally go through every bag of trash in a dumpster and pull out each one individually. He didn't do that the next day.
Yeah,
but again, so I guess it's an immersive learning experience, and it's one where we force you to change your habits. So
then do you try to place them when they're done? Is that part of your program or not?
The good thing is we never have a problem. We generally have more unfilled jobs that people are always calling me and saying, do you have any interns? Mm-hmm. So that part is generally pretty easy. We will usually, I always say it's like tryouts. So, or fishing. We throw the little ones back and we keep the big ones. So we keep the best ones for ourselves. And then generally the other ones have no trouble going out and getting a job because people are usually in a hurry to get our interns because they are going to be well prepared. And usually, because I tell them too, if this isn't for you, let us know in week one and get out.
Yeah.
Because why should you be here and be miserable? Don't be here and be unhappy. You might realize after a couple of days, this is definitely not for me. This is not what I want to do. And I would never say to somebody, oh, you made a commitment, you got to stay for 10 weeks. It's like, see ya. I'm glad you tried it, but
you've worked with so many NHL players, professional athletes. What, talk about toeing the line to where you got to be careful you don't blow them up in the training world. So
I think that's much, the thing you have to realize, I had this conversation, I did a podcast the other day. The first thing you have to realize with professional athletes is they were all professional athletes generally before they met you. So you have to have some level of respect for what they might have done before. When I went to work for the Red Sox, I called every single guy in the major league roster before I got there. And most of the guys were really nice. And I remember I was in the airport security line and I managed to get Josh Beckett on the line and I introduced myself and I ended up loving Josh. Josh was a really funny guy and easy to train once he trusted you. But he literally said to me, just so you know, I don't think I'm going to like you. I really like the other guy. I'm pissed off. He got fired. I might not even talk to you when spring training comes. So, and I was like, okay, it was really nice talking to you. See you in a couple of weeks in Fort Myers. And I called my wife and I was like, whoa, Josh Beckett just gave it to me bad. And I couldn't wait to hang up the phone and get off the line with him. But we ended up being really good friends. And I think with those guys, you just have to realize that some of them, what I found when I, particularly with the Red Sox, guys were all gung-ho at the start of spring training. I want to work out 4 days a week. After about 2 weeks, guys were like, I think I want to go to 3 days by the third week. I think I just want to keep doing two, get on my in-season program. And I just kind of let them lead the way. Because you can't badass pro guys.
Right.
You can't punk pro guys. Like if you do that, your career will be really short.
Yeah.
Because they don't have to listen to you. They can do whatever the hell they want. Most of them, Josh, you used to always remind me, you'd be like, Mike, I was really fucking good before I met you and I'm a millionaire. And I'd be like, you're right. You threw 100 miles an hour in high school and you were on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I said, I am well aware of your accomplishments. If you choose to listen, good. If you choose to not listen, also good. You will still have millions of dollars and you're still going to throw in the 90s. So you're going to be okay.
Well, it sounds like culture is important to you too. And so you were a part of the World Series run. What year was that?
2013
with the Red Sox. So what made that group? I know there's been so many documentaries and other things that people have talked about, but for you, like, what made that group so special, so cohesive and things like that?
They did an unbelievable job signing. When you look back and you think Ryan Dempster and David Ross and Shane Victorino, they literally signed guys based on character. They went out and said, we're going to get some of the best character role players, best teammates that we can possibly get. And they got a World Series out of it. Strangely, the next year they went and signed two guys who had terrible reputations as bad teammates. And I thought, why would you just won the World Series by doing it one way, and then you literally flipped the script the next year and did it a different way? But it made me realize pro sports is a very strange world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you would think that there would be this sort of patterning and let's just keep doing the same thing. But I have not historically seen that.
Yeah. I mean, personality matters so much. We talk about that a lot, too, with the people in our office and who we choose to associate with. It seems like that, you know, like you, it's nearly impossible to change human behavior. Like, people are pretty much are who they are.
They can change for a week or two, but it is hard to make people change.
Yeah.
Well, I always say I can make you smart. I can't make you nice.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, while we're wound it down, we do have a question from the audience, if you're up for it. So,
whatever.
Our buddy Jake wants to, he texted me, he's got a question he wants to ask. So come over here. See you in the mic.
All right. So in today's world.
Hey, before we start, fanny pack.
Dick.
Every time.
Come on. He didn't say it. All right. In today's world, the sport coach is kind of surrounded by athletes, whether it's high school or college, their clinician that they're working with, or with their high school coach or their high school trainer. So in their world of their school-based person, and then, hey, I'm working with someone on the side that's making me a better performer. If there's a message that you could put out for these future coaches that are coaching teams, but the future clinician that's operating with an athlete while that athlete's working with a coach like yourself, what would be like a message that you can say off of experience that would be put them into a better spot, whether that's the coach or the clinician?
Truthfully, I would tell them, because it particularly as either the coach or the clinician is an ex-player, and I would tell them, be a better teammate, because you have to figure out what is in the kid's best interest and how to get along. And that's not difficult, because sometimes high school coaches can be incredibly out of date. And sometimes, again, some of these clinicians or people like me or specialists or whatever they are can also be, as we said, dicks who aren't easy to get along with. So it's looking at it from the standpoint of what is in this kid's best interest. But sadly, that's a really hard sell, because it's interesting. Ryan Holiday spoke this morning, but ego is the enemy, right? I mean, that was the title of the book, and it's very, very true. Right. Ego is literally the enemy, because you're going to be in a situation where you're constantly battling the egos of people. And that we saw that in baseball, you've got pitching coaches and hitting coaches and trainers, and you're always trying to figure out how to navigate that world. So that's why I'm a really big soft skill guy. When people ask me about books, most of the books I would tell you to read would probably have nothing to do with strength and conditioning. I would tell you that, like, if you knew my morons periodization system and you knew does it hurt and you knew basic exercise technique, you'd be fine. If you had read How to Win Friends and Influence People, and if you had read 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, and some of these other, if you'd read Slight Edge, there's so many of these other books that are going to be way more important in terms of how you deal with people. Because one time somebody asked me why I was successful, and I said, I think I'm successful because I can get people to do what I want them to do. So I could get a guy like Cam Neely, who didn't want to lift weights, to lift weights. And I've always been able to get people. I could get a guy like Josh Beckett, who told me he was going to hate me, to like me. And we could goof around and have fun and be friends. And that's the real skill, whether it's in your office or whether it's in a strength and conditioning facility, whatever it is. If you can get people to be compliant, then you'll probably be successful. So
I mean, I think that's an amazing message. I think that's what we all struggle with, is changing human behavior and getting people to
just talk about
that.
It for 2 hours.
Yeah, so, literally.
Yeah, exactly. That's, you think about it, that's what you're trying to change human behavior. And most of the time, you know, what do they talk about? Know, like, trust, right? They want to know you. They want to like you. They want to trust you. They want to think that you give a shit. I used to have one of our football coaches, when we talk about recruiting, he was always like, I want a kid with a give a shit meter that runs really, really high. And I would think that's a pretty good description of just about anybody that you want. And you think, who do I want working in the clinic for me? I want someone with a give a shit meter that runs really, really high. I want someone that it's important to, probably someone like me. I mean, I have incredible fear of failure, incredible imposter syndrome. And I think that's what makes me good, because I'm always worried about not being good. I was worried. I was on the plane reading through my notes and writing notes about my presentation, because I thought, this is a pretty intelligent audience that you're going to talk to here. It's not your average group of personal trainers.
Well,
so I did hear a comment from the peanut gallery there, but supposedly intelligent audience that, but I think if you don't have a little bit of that, you probably won't be very good.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's a fine line. We always thought cockiness versus what's the other C word? Certainty. And so understanding where your flaws are a little bit, and kind of where your you know, where your holes are, and filling them and paying attention to them, I think is a good message. So well, Mike, I thank you for sitting down with us, number one. But kind of to Jake's question there too, like, if you could kind of I don't know, it's for some reason the strength conditioning and the manual therapy world just haven't like really dove in together, and it always just kind of seems like they're butting heads. Give our listeners a little bit of a pep talk on why we should be talking to our strength conditioning people, and why we should be having conversations like this with you and other people like that.
Because you want better outcomes. And the one thing that you'll realize is that you need to be able to be comfortable sharing influence. And I think what happens is some people, they have too much of a desire to be the guy or the girl, and to be the person who's calling the shots and the person that that athlete listens to. Instead of thinking, what I really want is I want that athlete to do well. So for me, I'm very adamant about, I want to find good clinicians, again, that I know, like, and trust, that I can send my athletes to and know that they're going to get the attention that I think they should get, and that that person's not going to be, because I've been through it, they're not going to be bad-mouthing me when I'm not there.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah,
again, happens. It's amazing how often people will use the opportunity to be alone with the athlete to kind of shift the blame to somebody else.
So
and
true.
Say, yeah, like, if, you know, if he was smarter, you wouldn't be hurt.
Right.
You wouldn't be in this situation, versus looking at it and being collaborative. Because again, I look at it and think, when I'm learning, and when I was learning at my best, I was learning from physical therapists, doctors, chiropractors, and you've got to be able to get outside of your little sphere of strength and conditioning coaches and realize that if you really want to get better, you have to be able to move outside your comfort zone and get into somebody. So I would spend a lot of time. One of the things, I would always go to the evaluations, because I wanted to watch the clinician work. I wanted to listen, especially when they were good, because I wanted to hear the questions that they asked and how they asked the questions and what the questions were, what was important in their evaluative process. And that, for me, it made me a way better coach.
Yeah.
And then it made me much more confident in saying, hey, we're going to go and see Taylor. You know, we're going to go and see Brett. We're going to go in, and I'm going to sit there with you. And then we're going to try to get to the root of this problem. And then we're going to figure out how we solve it. Because I'm going to have much more opportunity to solve it than you will. You might be able to see them maybe an hour a week.
Maybe. Yeah.
And I might be able to see them 8 hours a week. Which means if I can reinforce what you want them to do, then we can really have some success. And if I can understand what you want them to do, why you want them to do it, that makes a really big difference. Because the other thing that I found is then I can start to integrate that into my program. So, classic example, we were talking about this today. Sorry, I know I'm dragging this out longer than I should, but
perfect. Keep going.
We stretch. We stretch every day. We static stretch every single day, and we static stretch before we work out. And people get all freaked out about it. But one thing I realized in the 90s, I got taken up in the dynamic warm-up because static stretching reduces power and blah, blah, blah. So we did nothing but dynamic warm-up. And every time I took my hurt guys to physical therapy, first thing they'd say is, hamstrings too tight, hip flex too tight, hip rotator's too tight. We got to do a lot more stretching. And I thought, well, if this is always what happens every time we take somebody to be evaluated, why don't we just start doing this again? And then I started to investigate why we weren't doing it. And then I realized that the evidence for why we weren't doing it was actually pretty poor. And we had kind of run down, because again, we're very lemming like in our field. We all want to run off the same cliff as rapidly as we can, right? Ideally right after the strongest guy in front of us. But so
true.
Yeah. And so now, like I said, we foam roll. People, foam rolling doesn't work. I'm like, I think it does. Static stretching's bad for you. We do it every day. Whatever. I'm like, and I'm always like, dude, look, I could give a shit. I'm just gonna do what I'm gonna do. You can write stuff on forums about me and post on Twitter and do whatever. If you show me that I'm wrong and show me really good evidence and show me that, you know, something, I have hundreds of clients and I found this to happen.
Yeah.
But usually the guy who's shitting on you doesn't have hundreds of clients.
Right.
And you hate, and people always say, like, for me, oh, you always fall back on the clients and the age and the success that you've had. And I'm like, yeah, probably. Like, that's a reasonable thing to fall back on. We have a shitload of clients. They've made a real lot of money. They've been really healthy. Okay. We might want to look at our system and think that that's telling us that our system is pretty effective.
Yeah. Experience matters.
It does. Yeah. And you're going to be wrong. And then the flip side is you've got to be ready to change. When you find out, I always say I was wrong right up to the second I knew I was wrong. Then I was right again. Cause I changed. If I knew it, like, okay, that wasn't right. Boom. Then we'll start doing it differently. I remember that, like, my first McGill lecture. I remember thinking, wow, we're doing so much stuff wrong. I just sat there and I went back. I looked at everybody and I was like, you know, all because we were doing, before I saw McGill, we did abs. Then everybody did abs, right? Everybody did abs at the end of the workout. You know, we did like bicycle crunches. You know, we did all kinds of stupid shit. And why do we do it? Because that's what everybody did.
Right.
And I went back and said, all that shit's out. We're not doing that anymore. And everybody's like, what are you talking about? I said, just heard a really smart guy talk, and he said all the stuff we were doing wasn't very good, so we're going to do some different stuff.
Yeah, course correction. I think that's another important. Yeah.
And you've got to, you can't, and it's weird because you can't be like zigzagging all over the place, but you have to know when you encounter that person that you know is smarter than you, you need to recognize that and be prepared to make the course correction, whether that was Gary Gray, whether that was Greg Cook, whether that was McGill. There's been a lot of those people kind of in my life where I've looked and thought, Shirley Sarman. Mm-hmm. And I read Shirley's stuff and I thought, okay. Initially, I didn't even understand it. I had to keep reading it. I had to read it 3 and 4 times sometimes. And then I started to think, okay, I get it. Right. I understand where she's coming from and I understand why. So suddenly things that we did before, we're like, no, we're not going to do that anymore. So that's been the evolution, I guess, of the program.
I think we had Mike Leahy, who's the originator of ART, active release technique, and he off camera he told us, you know, hey, we're like, Mike, what do you think? And everybody's kind of like trashing you on the mechanisms, blah blah blah. And he says, listen, my phone is literally blowing up at this second with NFL and Major League Baseball players wanting to see me. I think I must be doing something right. That's right. And you are a prime example of the same thing. Yeah. You wouldn't have the people that you are if you weren't doing something right in those situations. So.
Exactly. And that's where I think in that kind of evidence-based crowd, people have to look at that and think, I get it. But you have to go back and you have to really read studies and you have to look at it and say, okay, has somebody really tried this in a very real-world setting? And is it working? Because what I want to know more than anything is what's working.
Right.
What are the best people doing and why are they doing it?
Yeah, and course correct when you find those things that shake your fundamentals. You know, like have the principles there. And then when your principles seem like they're changing a little bit, then just be adaptable and ask the questions and take that piece of information and then apply it. And then if it doesn't work, you can always change again. You know, like that's part of life. So it's your clinical recognition, your clinical expertise, and those types of things. So love it. Love it. Well, Mike, thanks again for sitting down with us.
Thank you guys for having me. I love doing it. I could do this all day.
Yeah. So. Well, you know, this is classic Las Vegas, man. It's loud and we got people hooping and hollering.
Yeah, hopefully whoever's listening can hear us.
The good news, there's this stuff called AI and it just blacks out all the background noise and it's good as new. So honestly, I live for the comments on YouTube and on our podcast of people kind of complaining about the video quality or like the audio maybe a little bit. That makes me so happy. So
Okay, yeah, you're right up my alley.
Yeah.
I live for the cause. Sometimes people, I'm like, I shouldn't sit up at night on Twitter drunk until 11 o'clock arguing with some idiot, but I can't. My wife be like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I can't stop myself.
That's okay, nothing. Yeah. I'm not doing it again.
Yeah. No, she knows what I'm doing. I don't know why she even asked. She knows exactly what I'm doing. I'm arguing with some fool in, you know, whatever, Oklahoma.
I love it.
Living in his parents' basement.
We'll talk about the people that we're fighting with on social media once the camera turns off. But, Mike, I appreciate you, brother.
Okay.
Hey, thanks for everything. Can't wait to listen to you tomorrow.
Thank you guys very much for having me.
Stay tuned for more of our Vegas trip, and good luck with patience. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Gasol Education Show. If you liked it, share it, subscribe to it, send it to your friends, send it to someone that needs to hear this message. We really want everyone to be able to tune in and get the best clinical advice that they can, which we're hoping that we're giving to you with these special guests. So if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out to us, or if you have any suggestions on upcoming conversations, let us know. For a list of our upcoming courses, we're adding them all the dang time. So go to gestaltedu.com, click on courses, and they'll all be right there for you. All right, have a good day.